Well, hello, superstars, and welcome back to another episode of Word Up with Dani Katz. Today I am joined by the DMSO doctor herself, Amanda Vollmer, and it was such a pleasure to get to drop in with Amanda. She is such a deep, deep, soulful, multidimensional powerhouse. Our conversation absolutely delivered. We went all over the place in terms of Amanda's path, her Kundalini awakening, how she landed in the realms of naturopathy. We talk about DMSO, we talk about urine therapy, we talk about longevity, we talk about all the fun things. Before we dive into today's juicy conversation, I am inviting you to click that subscribe button to like, to share, to comment, to leave this podcast a glowing review on whatever platform you are tuning in on. Also reminding you to sign up for my newsletter at dannykatz.com. It's the very best way to ensure that we get to stay in touch. As we are talking about all things health and healing today, I am inviting you to check out my Language of Healing webinar. It is a phenomenal program that supports us in using our every word and thought in programming our body for accelerated and total healing, for optimal health and well-being. It is a phenomenal program tool to accompany any healing protocol, even if we're delving into the realms of standard issue allopathic Western medicine. There is no conflict there. We can all be using our every word to uplevel our health at every moment. So do check that out over on my website and buckle up and prepare to enjoy my conversation with the lovely Amanda Vollmer. Amanda Vollmer, how are you? Nice to see you.
Hi, Danny. Nice to see you too. I'm
First and
great.
foremost, I love your blouse, and if you were here in person, I would rip it off you and steal it. It's so cute.
All right. It buttons all the way down, by the
Oh, wow. I'm a big fan of the button shirts.
Yeah, I've lately found a few blouses. I've been into blouses, so that I have.
Blouses. It's your se the season of the blouse.
It is, yes.
How are you? How's your summer going?
It's an interesting summer, really quite packed. Sort of had moments where I was really quiet, not much going on, and then it felt like everything happened within a month. So then go, and now it feels like autumn is already here. It's been like pressure cooker heat, and then it's like they turn the switch off and now it's autumn. Like that. It's so strange. Not like how I remember weather being like, it's like we don't really get a spring. It just is cold and damp and feels still kind of an extension of winter. And then summer switches on and it's crazy hot and weird. And then that switches off and then it's autumn. I really watch those patterns to see like year after year what happens. I guess I'm a weather watcher. I'm interested in that, especially since they're manipulating it. But they definitely have been working on their plan to dry out our forests to set fire to them, to get the mining underneath and to displace people and continue their climate change hoax. So that's been in my face here. I've had to be very careful about watering and water conservation. And like, I'm on a well, so I have to be like really thinking, about not draining it. But now I'm even thinking about getting one of those huge like containers to fill as backup water.
Like rain catchment.
Not
Those
even
are smart.
just rain catchment, but yes, but also where I could like have water trucked in and have them filled for backup, because people have saved their houses by, watering their roofs. And I'm like, gosh, I wish I don't have to think like this. So now I'm starting to go like, oh, did I really, like if a fire came and it came very close to us, I was like, what would I do? Like I never really, thought it all the way through as to my actions, and it's forced me to really look at it like that. So it, and not out of fear, just out of like, okay, I wasn't on my take, it wasn't on my plate to think of it like that, but that was got a little bit intense. So that was kind of new. So that was part of my summer thinking. And more gardening in the future is part of my thinking as well. Getting a greenhouse. And yeah, lots of my daughter's been busy, like camp and cottage. She went to a festival, a yoga festival she just got back from. And yeah, it's been she's had a good time. I've been more so housebound, but she's had a good summer.
When in your earth walk did you start to clue into things like weather manipulation, like a darker hidden agenda?
Well, I was suspicious for a long time in my youth, being someone who was really sensitive. And then it wasn't till university when I read Buckminster Fuller where I really started to tune in that, yeah, there's a cabal or there's like an enemy, if you will, that's manipulating things. And, 9/11 was big for a lot of us, I think, too, where we realized how weighted it was, that it wasn't just an idea or it wasn't just a thought form. They were doing this, there was action. And then university just, it was all around the same time for me, but like I had my awakening in 2000, like my big awakening, my Kundalini experience, and it all unfolded like over time. The weather portion itself, I don't have a fine like date as to when I was like, yes, you don't think to write those things down, or you don't think, it just kind of comes to you, or it slowly interweaves itself. But it's been a while. It's been all around that time, I think probably post university when I really knew about weather manipulation as an actual like patented program, and then learning in layers, as you go.
Would you be open to telling us about your Kundalini awakening? Was it something you were like training for, preparing for, or was it a spontaneous out of the blue, like, what the hell is this?
Yeah, it was that part. Yeah, it was I was post university, freshly graduated with a agricultural biotechnology degree, which wasn't something I had headed for on purpose per se, meaning that's what I wanted as my end result, but it was prerequisite to going to veterinary college that I took that degree. And so therefore my goal was to get into veterinary college, but I was going to take a gap year to recover financially. And in the hopes that since I had such degree in biotechnology that I would move to Quebec where my boyfriend was doing his visiting year at Concordia to then apply to ag biotech jobs, which I applied to maybe 150 jobs, and I only got perhaps five interviews, and they were all very extremely disturbing, and it was a very difficult year for me. I wasn't
Wait,
in,
can
yeah.
we slow down? Because I want to know, A, what ag biotech jobs are, and then what it was about the interview process that was disturbing for you.
Well, agricultural biotechnology is biotech is basically like Monsanto, working for the enemy, working for Monsanto, working for Syngenta, working for, all of the big ag GMO based companies. And what my training was in ha it was how to genetically manipulate seeds to create their GMO seed program, okay? And that's what and of course, it was all the sciences leading up to that, just like a 4-year degree offers. And that's why it overlapped nicely with all the prereqs that I would need to get into veterinary college, plus all the extras. And I challenged them harsh when I was in university. I already knew what they were up to, and I wasn't into that. But I was like, But what if I got in there? Like, I could be a whistleblower. Like, this was my thinking back then.
Got it.
But I wasn't fluent in French, and that was one of the barriers. You needed to ha be fully bilingual, like as bilingual as you would be to become a politician. My odds of becoming a politician were probably easier than getting a job with my degree. And also, it was very sexist. I was kind of shocked. There was the one offer where I could have gotten that job if I pushed, would have meant I would have had to sleep with the boss to get the job. And I was like, you can go sit on this and rotate. And I left, but I was really disgusted. That was my final interview where I was hit on by the interviewer, and it sounded like he was hinting at me getting my position by getting into a position, you know? and that was the end for me. I was like, this is gross. Why am I? Obviously, it's saying no, right? I'm being protected by rejection. It's saying no. I know you're here for that, but it's a failure to launch, which means there's another direction for you
So you
somewhere.
were already attuned to like a larger intelligence guiding you at that stage of your life?
Yeah, I was vacillating back and forth between like very physical reality, you know, you create your reality kind of idea by forcing things. Then, and I was also on the other side of that where, because I studied all kinds of religions in high school. I was very curious, even though I went to a Catholic high school. When we had our religious studies class, I was fascinated by Buddhism and Hinduism and Taoism, and I took my studies into that, and I knew of those philosophies. So therefore, they were, you know, my crutch in those times of difficult decisions. And I just resounded to this feeling of it's going to be okay, just listen, you know, to whatever is going to happen. And it just so happened, I called my friend who, out of desperation, I just needed a friend to talk to about what to do now. And she's like, come to California. We're at a non-denominational monastery in Dulzura, California. And we're here for like a month and a little bit more than a month, or we don't even know how long. But when we're done, we're going to drive up the coast. We're going to go see the Redwoods. And then we're going to head back to Edmonton, which is where I had just come from. I came from, well, actually, Calgary. So I went to school in Alberta, Lethbridge. I lived in Calgary for a year, then I went to Montreal, and then I ended up going to California and full circle ending up back in Alberta, but this time in Edmonton. It was like Alberta wasn't done with me yet, you know? And that experience of going to California, what that process was, it was more of a theosophical foundation. And they did very specific meditations 4 times a day. And then you had a bunch of free time. Basically, you just had to do a little bit of volunteering. And like you had your day a week where you were cooking. And for the most part, you could do whatever you wanted. I was sunbathing, I was meditating. They had an extensive spiritual library. I was reading the oldest books I could find. I was right into my spiritual, you know, knowledge bank at that point. And it was great because it was perfect. 'Cause obviously, I was having a type of spiritual crisis at that moment. So this was beautiful for me. And I got my piercing at that time too, because I felt like this was my true confirmation time. This was my time of honoring that I'm an adult and I'm now responsible for my spiritual knowledge. I don't rely on anybody else now to hand that to me. It's on my plate to do, and I will honor that to do it. And that's why I got the nose ring at that time, to remind myself of my oath to myself. And I read a Tibetan text that I wish I could find again. That actual monastery burnt down about 10 years ago now. I think they had massive fires through there. I don't know how much they salvaged. They did build back after, but you know, they had a really hard time for a while. But I read this text, and there was an exercise in it where you lit up your chakras one by one and then start to spin your egg in two different directions. I'm like, that's kind of cool. I'm gonna do that, you know? And I took the book and myself into one of these trailers. They had really cool spaces for people to stay. Ones were like fancy trailers, some were like little huts, whatever, right? So I took myself into a fancy little trailer and I laid down on the bed or couch or whatever. I think it was a flat bed though, because there was no back to it. And when I look right or left, you know, I had the wall next to me and then above that the window, and then on the other side was just the space. So I did it. Innocent, very innocent. No expectations. I didn't, there was no thinking. There was no thinking. It was just, I'm just doing it. Did it, and I really saw the whiteness once I started spinning in the two directions. I'm like, ooh, I can really see white, like a see-through white. And I'm like, this is cool. I thought, and I started feeling really interesting sensations. And then I looked to my right and I was like, oh, isn't it so pretty outside? Like, it's really a beautiful sunny day. And I was just remarking how gorgeous it was outside. But then I realized at that moment, how could I be looking out the window? Because I was on the bed, which didn't have the window until it was up there, right? Like, I was at the level of the back of the trailer. So the moment I realized that I was off the bed, okay, because that was the only way I could see out the window. And then I started to look around me and realize that I'd spun it so well that I actually created it physically around me and pushed myself off the bed. And I freaked out because my mind then shut it down, and I fell to the bed with a thump, with a thud. And that was like, I wish someone was there to, you know, or I videoed it, whatever. But of course, because my mind was so innocent, I think that's why it happened, because I couldn't recreate it afterward. I think there's a purity there to our creations, and I warped my own space around me with this method. And I was like, oh my gosh, I can't even believe this. I shouldn't tell anybody because that's weird and whatever, right? Like, and then you start to gaslight yourself and doubt yourself and like, did I really do that? And all this kind of stuff started happening. So I didn't really tell anybody. I just went and put the book back and went to dinner kind of stunned. And then we did our night meditation. Then I went to retreat to my tent, which was under this beautiful tree. And it was like, I was listening to Joni Mitchell on my cassette tape, because that's what you
Nice.
do when you're in California.
Totally.
And that's, I went to bed with that, sleeping like that. And then I woke up, or I was woken up by these coyotes that, there were, I think I recall at least seven of them. And they knew I was there, obviously, because they were howling right in front of my tent. And if you've ever been that close to a howling coyote, it's very loud. Okay. They're very loud up close. And I was scared because it was vibrating my body. So I had to, I was plugging my ears as each, so they would sit in front of me, then that one would howl and go, and then another would sit in front of me, howl and go, and this kept happening. And I was just had to sit there and endure. And they eventually moved off, and I went back to sleep. And then in the morning, early morning, I was awoken again by this shushing sound around the tent. And I was like, what is this now? You know, like, what creature's here now? And I opened the tent up, and there, I couldn't even count them all, maybe 40 or 50 bunnies or hares or wild hares were all around my tent. And that's what the shushing was their body rubbing against the tent. And I walked out and they didn't run. Like, they were just hanging with me. And I went, what is happening right now? And then I looked out, and I had this moment where my whole Kundalini heat kind of energy was coming up from my base all the way up, and I thought I was going to pass out as I was looking out. And I could see energy, like of the trees. I could see through everything. Like, I can't really describe it, but it was almost like I was seeing the programming of this place behind it or through it or of it, the next levels or dimensions of it. And I was struck with this absolute unconditional love sensation. And I wept because it was so beautiful. The colors you can't even describe. It was just so beautiful that I just, in that moment, I just knew everything was God. Like everything that exists is of us, is of the divine. There's no separation. Like that's when I saw it, you know? And then I was like floating for a while. I became this very new agey kind of woman for a while after that, because there you don't really have a anchor. Well, now I feel we do, but back then, like 25 years ago, all I had was some metaphysical texts, you know, and like Madame Blavatsky stuff. I didn't really have a true ground for what I was experiencing. And what happens is you just search for whatever's going to try to answer your questions. And but I was super love and light, I'll tell you. I was like the most annoying super love and light person you would ever meet. Okay, more annoying than the breatharians I was meeting at that place. Like someone would tell you their problem and you'd be like, but it's all love, man, you know, like yeah. But then it changed the whole trajectory of my life. My fiance wouldn't have it, so that, you know, my relationship of 9 years, and my, you know, that fell apart, that whole thing fell apart, and it changed everything. So for me, yeah, very, very potent time that. Not everybody goes through you know, their awakening in the same way. Mine was kind of intense like that.
I'm intrigued. I mean, for lots of reasons. I love hearing about people's Kundalini awakenings. And so I understand you were in this kind of like love and light, probably like namaste, 10-minute hugs, wide-eyed, low sultry voice, like that thing. What has stayed with you, and how did that experience shift you, like at a core level?
I would say, again, it was like a gradual process of how I integrated all of this. And I would say, like, through ha about half of university, or maybe even three quarters, I was pretty annoying. I was like in my spiritual ego. I didn't know that there were phases, even, right? It took me a while, maybe by the end of my 4th year, because I had new challenges come up, is when my all the spiritual I had like the honeymoon phase. And then the next challenges came after that. And so I feel like it sobered me at that point, where I realized there was still an ego layer there. That I was not having proper boundaries. I was overconfident in some ways. And I still, even though I thought I'd healed a lot of my trauma, there were still parts that were at play subconsciously. Even though I was bringing a lot of it to conscious mind, there were still programs running that I wasn't able to get reflection on until around that time. And that kind of sobered me and grounded me into, okay, next, the next is the next phase of this whole awakening situation, where I don't know, it's a maturing of it or a fermenting of it that happens. What I kept was the inside of me, that knowing always has stayed with me of what we are, and, you know, kind of in some senses why we're here, and the infinity of it all and the eternal nature of who we are. That's always stayed with me. I think where it's vacillated has been, what is my role now, and what is my purpose today, and how does that evolve, change? And those times in which my faith is questioned, where I feel unplugged from the knowledge of the all, and I feel unsteady on my feet, what that's about, what I'm supposed to be doing there. I felt like I was getting in a codependent relationship with God. Like, tell me what to do now, direct me, I'm your vessel, like this kind of stuff. And then, but slowly realizing that the whole point of us to forget was so our we could have our individuation take place, and our return to preciousness happen, and this sort of thing. And that means, again, another layer of the spiritual adulthood was taking place, right? Where you are learning to trust yourself in a different way. And I feel I'm still massaging the whole language around that. I mean, I feel like the English language can be limiting for that. I almost wanted to learn Latin. I thought about learning Latin because I felt like there has to be another language to explain these sensations, the teachings, the experiences, and so forth. And I've just resounded to it's okay to not have, it's not really, I don't need to explain it. You know what I mean? Like, it's okay that it is what it is, and just coming into acceptance of that. And that's where I feel I've come to now, is just an acceptance space. Before, I felt I had some savior programs running, still a lot of inner child hurt, pain that I was processing, a lot of wanting to, like, knowing I'm a co-creator, so that therefore I should always be manipulating my experiences. And now that I'm past, now I'm in my 50s, I'm in a third phase of life, I'm in the coming into crone energy. It's a very different mode of wisdom, teaching, action or inaction. And I feel like I'm learning all over again what I'm to do. And so I don't have, I'm not in that place where I even feel I have or want to have even these, like, clear-cut answers. Because I read today that decision making from a Chinese medicine perspective comes from the heart. And when we live in a world that constantly puts upon us decision making very quickly and often, and it can exhaust the heart and put us into less compassion, and more, and then it leans more on the liver and the kidneys when, right, when you're still needing the energy to do it, but the heart is tired, which means that this becomes more stress or strained decision making, basically, and can have repercussions on the tone and the manner in which we're making those decisions, which can be rushed or anxious based decisions, or come across really an unkind method of, like a barking an order rather than a contemplative response, this type of thing. And it really stuck with me today because I feel like I've been taken out of this chronic decision-making life now on purpose, which is, I've had a codependent relationship with that as a business owner and a mother and all those things. And it's scary a bit because I used to do things very quickly and rapid fire and get a lot done. And now, no, now you can't, you're not supposed to. Okay, how do I do things now? I don't know. It's gonna be different. It's gonna be more, it's gonna be slower, or it's gonna come in waves, or whatever. I don't even have the verbiage for it yet because I'm still developing in it, but it's interesting. And I couldn't, the me that had the Kundalini awakening couldn't have perceived this now, right? But here we are, like, here I am. So yeah, it's very, very, very interesting.
I'm always struck, Amanda, by your self-awareness and a humility combined with like a deep wisdom and intelligence. And I love, given all that you've accomplished, the willingness to be in the like, well, maybe my mission is changing, maybe my purpose is changing, and maybe I don't know. Like that, I feel like that modeling is so important for us, that like life is never done, our path is never done. That willingness to just stay open and flexible and nimble, and maybe it's changing and I don't know how to do it like this. So just, as a fellow woman, I really appreciate that in you. Given that
Thank you.
it was I believe a Tibetan exercise that you were practicing, do you feel a unique connection to the Tibetan lineage? Do you feel like maybe there was some like past life experiences that contributed to this awakening in this lifetime?
I have felt connected, and that's what put after my awakening process, I did practice formally Tibetan style Buddhism for 2 full years under a Rinpoche as well, and in Edmonton. So that beautiful trip did lead me back to Edmonton and then a Buddhist community. And I lived in the Rinpoche's backyard in two tents. One was my dressing chambers, and the other was my bed chambers. And I would take instruction from him every morning. That was for 1 summer I did that until it got too cold, obviously. And that's when I applied to University of Alberta to work in their animal lab section of there, which was another eye-opener for me. But yes, I did feel connected to specifically the Tibetan style of Buddhism. I found it very loving and non-judgmental, accepting of everyone and wherever you were at, kind of feeling, because when you come into something like that, it can be very vulnerable. So I felt I could trust that group of people, the sangha, the dharma I had with those people was very formative and healing for me. So I was very practiced at that point. At the 2 year mark, then even slightly around that time, I went to India. I went to India on 2 different occasions. So right when I started naturopathic college, which was 2005, 2004, 2005, that summer, then I went to India. And I went for a volunteer medical program where you shadow different doctors and also like homeopaths and other natural medicine, Ayurvedic practitioners, so forth. And that was the first month. And the second month, I stayed extra so I could visit my Tibetan family that I had. So for many years, even before Buddhism, I had sponsored my family sponsored one child, and I sponsored another child. So when they had to leave Tibet, the families were broken up, so there were a lot of families that took extra children to raise, and it put a financial strain on them. So there were agencies that would help garner donations for those children. And I went to a Tibetan bazaar. This was even before I was really practicing, and I saw these children, and I felt a pull. And so I helped to raise one boy, and I got another paper of this girl for my parents, who they supported her for many years, for like a decade, monthly payments kind of thing. So, and they just flourished. It was wonderful to see. And so I wanted to meet the family that I had been supporting. And so when I stayed the extra month, I went to Dharamsala and met them and stayed with them. And that's when I went to go, this was like my second Kundalini at that time. Then I went to do Vipassana meditation, in Dharamsala, and that was a 10-day silent retreat. And then I had my own out-of-body experience at that point, which was really awesome. And got to really understand them, and be in understand the monkhood as well. And I started to see some cracks in some of the religious aspects, A lot of the male monks were had a lot of sexual problems. The celibacy, I don't think, was working well for them. It led to some deviant behavior and things, and so I started to see other issues going on there. And but it was really quite wonderful. And then I still practiced a lot of those religious beliefs, or I integrated, I guess, a lot of the rituals. I just felt like my culture and the religion I grew up with didn't have the rituals that meant anything to me. Like, I don't know, it just going to church and sitting in the pew and doing the thing and eating the thing, and I don't know, it just didn't, the Jesus thing didn't ever click with me. But the Buddhism and the understanding of the different aspects of the self, the Godhead, if you will, kind of aspects, and the trickle down, that made more way more sense to me. And it gave me rituals that worked, like having a puja, like having the lighting candles, the incense, the offering of food, the it just it worked with me. So maybe I was past life for this calling. I won't know until I go home, but it felt more familiar to me, it felt more comfortable to me, it felt m more practical as well for me. So, yeah.
There's a lot of crossover between us. I did my first Vipassana in India as well, in 2000, up north in Bodh Gaya, and I also spent a lot of time in a Mahayana Buddhist tradition, but I was always getting in trouble for like breaking the rules or pointing my feet at the Buddha. And after a couple of years, I ended up leaving. But then whenever I've had like a really deep, mind-blowing meditation or really intense psychedelic journey, all the visuals that I see come from the Tibetan tradition. So I know there's mojo there. And at the same time, I had my own heartbreaks in, finding out about the Dalai Lama and Nexium and, my own interactions with Robert Thurman. And just like, it was one of my last, I call them binkies, but like one of the last pieces of my worldview that was like, I had a rug pull of like, wait a minute, this whole realm is not what I think. But yeah, I still have so much respect for those traditions for sure.
Yeah, I can relate exactly to that. I had the similar experience and awakening, especially when I started to dive down a lot of different rabbit holes. I think the turning point for me, especially even though I knew about the issues with the Dalai Lama and the Panchen Lama story as well, was when he was when there was that scandal where the Dalai Lama was sucking the young child's tongue, and it didn't it was whatever happened inside of me at that moment, I was like, this is, it's so wrong on multiple levels, but there's something foundationally wrong here. And so actually I spoke with my sister, my Tibetan sister about it, and they're very devout to the Dalai Lama. You cannot question his motives. And I came with respect, but I just wanted to understand her perspective on why that would be okay. And she defended him, and I said, I but how? Oh, it's just normal in our culture. I'm like, well, there's cultural ideologies that are aside from child development knowledge, that we know, like marrying too young has serious psychological consequences, or sex too early, etc. Like, these are, we know this from a child psychology format now. Like, we need to move into the modern era of like where that's inappropriate, and like, would you allow that to happen to your child? Kind of question. And that's when I saw the what is it, the religiosity, cult mindset problem there, and it was upsetting because they then left me. Like, the abandonment happened at that point because we disagreed on this foundational principle, even though I thought we could respectfully disagree. But what ha ended up happening is, I guess I triggered her with the conversation, and so when I publicly on Facebook started to ask these questions and talk about it, she became a troll, actually, of all those posts, and it was very upsetting. It was extremely upsetting, and I had to end up just responding like to every one of them. And sometimes I had to delete them. This it was just you could tell when someone is emotionally like just floundering. I had to like clean that up or try to clean that up, and then she ended up blocking me, and that was really tragic because that was a long relationship that we had, and I'm sad for that, but it is this is how this is the lesson that, you know, this is what we see from these belief systems and how we have to be very careful, you know, what we put stock in as far as like our ego identification into those beliefs, right? Because those could become a temporary crutch. Okay, sure, if you need that, I get it. But it once they become a permanent crutch, now you're in some sort of semi danger, because if that gets kicked out from under you at any point, you're going to feel like that's your own life being threatened, and therefore, right, you come at that very strongly, and sometimes destructively. And I really started to see that. And, you know, I dove into a lot of cult education. I even wrote a book on it that I had never published, but I started to see the similarities in the medical cult with actual like NXIVM cults and, you know, Scientology cults, et cetera, right? And so it really tuned me. So I saw then at that point, like this was still a cult, even though there's beauty that comes from it, even though there's worth inside of them. And I would say so with all religions, there's all of that. It's not like black and white. However, there's a cult programming running there too. And we have to be very careful. It's a very fine line to dance there. Yeah.
Absolutely, and it's something I've learned the hard way and continue to learn the hard way because I tend to call out distortions and hypocrisy in larger constructs, and then people who are aligned with those constructs have in the past taken those critiques personally, and it's like, no, it's not personal. You know, it's like whether we're talking about, you know, like the Rainbow Brigade or, you know, the people, Zionists, like whatever. It's like, that's great, respecting everyone individually, but we still have to be able to critique the construct, especially when these constructs are so flawed, as most constructs are, and just seeing where people will conflate their own allegiance to a construct with the construct. And that's when, you know, similar to you, I've had so many relationships go sideways because I haven't yet learned to keep my big mouth shut.
Yeah, the big mouth part. I'm getting like, I don't want to say better or worse. I think I'm learning, or I've learned now, that maybe until I have the real fire and passion behind me, I'm not going to say those things. Like, I've actually been challenged to not speak to certain things the last bit, which is interesting because I'm always the big mouth. And now I think because I'm retraining my boundaries, I'm retraining just the way I interact with the world. Okay, well, not my place to say it. And what I've allowed is in my mind, and what I see is it's okay for others to say it now. Like, it's okay. Like, I can pass the torch. There are many more awake than when I started, and I'm grateful for that. And I don't have to always carry every torch. I don't always have, like, I can put it down. I'm allowed to, you know? And I'm grateful when I see others picking up the torch now. I don't have to put my commentary on every social media post. I don't have to, you know, and it's actually very freeing in a way. At first it was daunting, because I think when you're considered an influencer, quote unquote, there's this pressure, this underlying pressure that you're supposed to know everything that's always going on all the time, like be up on the news, be up on the latest. And there seems to be this unspoken race to the top sort of feeling, like who gets there first or who gets to influence a new aspect first. And I always kind of saw this like weird quasi, I don't know, competition energy. And I am like anti-competition. Like, when I have to see any, like, I didn't even do sports because I was like, oh, I would only compete with my own benefit, like to my own, enrichment. That's how I would see competition. My daughter's the same way, which is really interesting. It's interesting to see like what she's picked up of me naturally, And that's one of the things she's like, I don't like sports. I'm like, oh, that's like me. She's like, yeah, I don't want to compete with another person and feel like I won over another loser, group. And I said, great. And the competition I like is to challenge myself on something and see how I do, And so even with that in the sphere of like, what am I doing here in the public eye? That's all shifting too. Mostly I've been going into private more and more and more and more. Like I trust the community that's around me. I trust the community that values me. I value them back, like this sort of reciprocity. And then I don't need to do the public. I'm only gonna do it if I'm truly motivated, truly inspired, and it's fun, like lifting and joyful. Like I did make a new TikTok account because that's all like been threatened so many times. But to like, so I'm like, I'll make a new one. And I was gonna do like some little parodies and stuff when I'm ready, when I feel like it's time. And that's about all I felt the last little while to even consider. The rest is very quiet, very focused, almost in a relearning stage, like reading texts again and sitting with books again. I feel like we go through these times where we're ed really deeply educating on something, and you don't talk about it when you're in it, and doing it. And then later it becomes something that you can talk about because you've learned enough, right? Yeah.
Again, I'm feeling so many parallels. A lot of times I've used my big mouth because like I can, right? So when COVID hit and I'd been covering, that whole realm since 2000, it was like, well, obviously I'm going to speak to this, and I know you were very vocal to that as well. And then I felt like, well, I've done enough, and plenty of other people have jumped into the space who know more than I do. So it's not really necessary for me to add my voice. And I'm curious to know, what is your take on the health freedom realm? Like, I don't like to use the word movement because I feel like movements are ops, and I don't feel like capital T Truth needs movements. But the way I see it is like, a lot of us, like OG conspiracy theorists, have been speaking truth to fake power forever. And then they pulled the FOVID op, and there's this like whole new crop who's like all excited to be there, which is great, like wonderful, super helpful. But I've noticed, like in my experience, it feels like there is some cult-like behavior happening in that group, or has happened, and I'm curious to know your take on it.
I think the only great movements are bowel movements. Those are the
Those
best. Yeah, those are the best movements.
good, though.
Or if you're doing a dance class, that's great movement too. But I hear what you're saying. Like, I think we're in an we ebb and flow with our awakening, right? We just it's like a jellyfish movement. How we awaken, that's how I kind of see it. Or I've explained like the spiral staircase that's on an angle. Like, so we go up and then we kind of look like we're going in reverse as we go down until we get to the next stage, kind of thing. I've been not really with the changes that happened over the like last year plus. I feel like what I saw from sort of an explosion in my life was that I'm not to participate in whatever most of that is right now. Like it's gotten, I don't know what, I don't, warped maybe, or just infiltrated definitely negative bent. And like I said, that competition energy as well. And also, of course, like the amount of what's allowed, right? I really watch for the trend of what is allowed to take off. And that's none of my work. So, like, right, like the shadow banning and all this is pretty heavy. If you're really speaking the stuff that the agendists are not interested in getting out there, then you know, like, you're on the right track. Like, just do the work quietly behind the scenes, and when it's ready, it will pop off. But the fact of like this pressure to get a certain amount of, likes on a post, and this game of getting noticed is getting old, and there's a new energy that's going to emerge or is emerging in the way we're going to communicate. Because as far as I feel, and I could probably speak for a handful of others, I'm exhausted by that phone and that computer and that social media world. Like I am very turned off of it. Like the scrolling, the doom and gloom stuff, the amount of data points that we get inundated with each day, even if you're only on there a few hours, is way more than our nervous systems really are wired to handle. I think it leads to apathy. I think it leads to nihilism. I feel that we lose our creativity through those structures, because we end up like comparing ourselves to others rather than doing our thing. I've been really just put off of it. I don't want to post that much. I don't feel like I want to add to it. Like, you know what I mean? I don't, this is part of our destruction. I don't want to add, I want to educate, but I don't want to add to our own destruction at the same time. And I'm like, there's a little bit of a push pull there. And in the whole, I don't feel like there's a health freedom movement. I think there's just been like people who try to tell the truth where they can. People who try to do good works where they can and get past the censorship, and then certain conferences and places where we collab a little bit and have those conversations, which I feel like we're not where we need to be on some of those gatherings. I feel like we may need to invent or emerge a new way of meeting or being together and talking about things that are functional, that aren't going to be bought out, bought off, or, infiltrated, which is, can happen very easily. And we already have been disappointed by like the politics. I think like there are still people who think RFK is gonna do this and that, and like the left-right belief system and stuff. Like it's still, there's still a lot of that going on. A little too much. We'll get there. I feel we'll get there. I just feel like the solutions are simpler than our brains. Our brains make everything complicated. And it's really just very simply starting with knowing who you are, frequency shift, so you're lifting your frequency as best as you can, right? Then where your own space is, like your own family, your own lifestyle, all of those things are all your decisions. And like, are you growing a garden? Are you collecting water? Are you, like, where are you thinking about your freedom and your sovereignty, right? Like, are you paying taxes still? Are you where do you contribute to this system? And
That does it for the first half of my conversation with Amanda Vollmer. I am strongly encouraging you to stick around for the second half because that's where we get into some brass tacks healing upgrades that you, me, and all of us can start implementing immediately to optimize our health, to extend our longevity. You can find the second half of this podcast on both my Locals and Patreon communities, so at dannycats.locals.com as well as patreon.com/dannycats. At both of those communities, for as little as $5 a month, you get access to all of my second half conversations, plus oodles of bonus content. So run, don't walk to sign up either on the Locals, the Patreon, or the both, so that you can join us for the second half of today's enlivening, enriching conversation. One last reminder to sign up for my newsletter at dannycats.com, to like, to share, to comment, to subscribe, and also to scope out my own language of healing program, which you can find on my website and which is a beautiful accompaniment to any healing initiations, up-leveling, optimizing protocols. Anything you're doing to optimize your vehicle will work well with my Language of Healing program. So you can find that. Last call, DannyKatz.com. Thank you so much for sharing your sacred attention with me. Thank you for remembering that every word matters, that you are omniscopic amazingness. I will see you over on the Locals and the Patreon. Have a rockin' day.